This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, signature support from the office of the Mayor-President of East Baton Rouge Parish, and our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start today with two people intricately involved in the life and times of one of the great writers of all time, certainly one of the most enormous man of letters of the last half of the 20th century, Norman Mailer, born January 31, 1923, Long Branch, New Jersey, died 10 November 2007 in New York City. In his 84 years, he was one of the most prolific writers of all time, two-time Pulitzer winner. And his first book, his novel, The Naked and the Dead, published in 1948, based on his war experience in Japan, brought him early recognition that was quite profound, and he was an international celebrity for almost 60 years. And now, some 16 and a half years after his death, there is new work that has been unearthed, and we're here to talk with his biographer and archivist, J. Michael Lennon, who's been with us many times, and Susan Mailer, his oldest child, who was with us one other time, and they both are keeping the flame alive of Norman Mailer. And good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Well, Michael, tell us about the latest work, the one that was found that has been massaged, and certainly it's true Mailer. He's controversial as always, even posthumously.
That's a good way to put it, Jim. It is a kind of a controversial book. I think you have to realize that it was not intended to be a book. It was intended to be a private journal. He had some thoughts about perhaps revising it and publishing it someday, but he never did, although he took ideas from it and even kind of ways of speaking from that book. He wrote it in 1954-55, and it was called Lipton's, which was what marijuana was called in those days by jazz musicians and a lot of people who were smoking it illegally, including Norman. And he decided that he wanted to chart the effects of marijuana on his life, which he felt was loosening him up, giving him new thoughts, helping him become more of a rebel. He was always, at that point in his life, going through a big change. Two other things, and then I'll let Susan chime in because she's got some great insights on this as well. His first book, as you said, was a terrific success, sold millions of copies, The Naked and the Dead. The second book was a bomb. It went down like a lead balloon. It didn't work at all. It was a very, it's an interesting book, but it's a polemic about politics, about Russia and the United States, about communism and socialism and capitalism and all of those things. And there isn't much of a storyline to it. It bombed, and he felt really bad. His third book was going to be about Hollywood. It was about Hollywood, the Red Scare. It was called The Deer Park. And it was supposed to be published by his publisher, Reinhardt. And at the last minute, Reinhardt objected to some of the sexual depictions in the book and pulled it, even after it had been advertised in Publishers Weekly. So Mailer was in, you know, distraught. He was worried. What was happening? I mean, he hadn't given up or anything like that. He wasn't in terminal despair, but he was very, very upset. And on that basis, over the course of 4 months, he wrote 100,000 words in his marijuana journal called Lipton's.
And so
some of the background.
The Deer Park ultimately was published, and it did not have the success of Naked and the Dead, but it is now considered one of his best works and one of the best works of the last half of the 20th century. Now, Susan Mailer was born just after the publishing of The Naked and the Dead. Her father was famous. And,
that's right.
And you saw him. He was a guy who not only had a upside and a downside publicly, but he did so privately, and he was very open about it. But one of the most fascinating creatures America has produced is Norman Mailer. And I knew he was a heavy drinker, but I did not know he also consumed marijuana. It's not really a surprise, but back in the day, this was something that was, it was taboo. And the book, Lipton's A Marijuana Journal, includes never-before-published letters between Robert Linder and Mailer, and they introduce the readers to Mailer's state of mind during the time that Michael mentioned. You were a young child during this period. How was that experience with your father at that point in your life?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have I didn't see any of that. I think he was pretty careful to not smoke when I was around, and I think I probably went to Bob Lindner's house maybe once or twice, or he came to our house in New York. But basically, I think even though my father was experimenting with marijuana and experimenting heavily, he pretty much protected us, or protected me, because I was the only child then, when I was around, because I was in Mexico part of the year with my mother, and the other part of the year I was with him, which is not to say that I didn't see the changes in him, because he went through some changes during that time when I was around 55, I was around 6 and 7. So I could see him. You know, he was he had a kind of strange aura around him. It was a kind of a black mood, or a kind of very thoughtful, let's have a very deep and intense talk kind of attitude with me. So I think that those were probably, looking back, those were probably times when he had smoking pot during the weekend, and he had all these thoughts that he wanted to somehow talk to me about. Not, I don't know why he would want to talk to a 7-year-old about that, but but he did. But he did. Just a few thoughts, you know, about how, about love, about being a father, about how difficult it had been for him to be a father. I think all those things, which, you know, you might wonder, why does a father tell a 7-year-old those thoughts that he's had? I think those were probably the effect of marijuana.
Well, our producers, Robin Dow and Renee Martin, have pulled a cut. And Norman was a talker. And if you go certain places, you can find a lot of his words in the verbal form. And, of course, he knew how to write a sentence or two or three. But here he is commenting on his use of marijuana.
My generation met marijuana. You know, when we were children, we used to hear marijuana spoken of as reefers, and only drug addicts took marijuana, so far as we knew, and they were sort of lurid tales in the tabloids. They would say victim of reefer madness, and so forth. So we grew up thinking that marijuana was evil. And I remember in the late 40s and the 50s, when some of us started smoking it, we felt wonderfully criminal, you know, as if we were truly breaking a frontier. And I remember in those days, the middle class had an intensely antagonistic attitude toward marijuana. I had friends who were young intellectuals who broke company with me because I was smoking it, you know, refused to see me. They felt about it, I think, the way people felt in London in 1890 about taking opium. And I, in turn, felt outraged that, you see, that they would let this company enter the friendship. I felt outraged, in fact, if they wouldn't smoke it. I was an advocate for it. What had happened is that, precisely because there were no other drugs of choice at the time, marijuana was the only drug, there were other drugs, but they were pills, you know, they didn't count, they were medicines. You took speed to speed yourself up, and you took Seconal to slow yourself down. But marijuana was the was the only thing remotely resembling a psychedelic drug at the time. And so we'd take it to get psychedelic experiences. I remember when Ella.
All right. That's Norman Mailer commenting on his use of marijuana and the perception at the time about why it was a bad thing. Now, Michael Lennon, that seems bizarre to hear those words today. When you go to any major city and you can smell marijuana on almost any street corner. But he was, as we know, a progressive in many ways, and turns out he was a progressive in this way.
Yes, he was. He was. He waited a long time for it. He stopped using it, you know, after the 50s. He used it a little bit in the 60s and so forth. But as he grew older, he became turned against it to a certain extent, believed that smoking too much of it was not necessarily good for you. But one of the reasons he was smoking it was he had a lot of thoughts about what society was like in the United States in the 1950s. It was a pretty buttoned-down affair. Eisenhower was in the White House, and he was putting a kind of a tamper on everything. There wasn't much movement going on. There were a lot of, in the cities, there was feelings of rebellion and so forth, that we've got to open this country up. Marijuana was one frontier. Sex was another frontier. Politics was another one. And all of those things came into what Mailer was writing about in the journal. I mean, he writes about marijuana in it quite a bit. But he also writes a lot about...
Okay, we do have to take a break, and we'll be back after this 89.3-second timeout with more. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're pleased to have J. Michael Lennon and Susan Mailer. Susan's the daughter of Norman Mailer, his oldest child, and J. Michael Lennon is his friend, archivist, and biographer. And they have kept the flame alive. There is a Mailer conference every year, and we'll hear from them a little bit about that before we part with them in short order. But they have a fascinating work that has been unearthed, Lipton's A Marijuana Journal, and it has largely correspondence between Norman Mailer and Robert Linder, who was the author of Rebel Without a Cause, and he was a friend of Mailer. And Mailer was into marijuana in the late 40s and 50s when others were not. And a listener, by the way, if you'd like to chime in, 877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org. A listener asked, and this may be for both of you who knew him obviously quite well, Michael later in his life and Susan when Norman was in his prime and doing marijuana, he was such a volatile, combustible man. What would he have been like without marijuana? Michael, did marijuana in some ways level him out?
Yeah, I think it did. I think he found an outlet for himself. It did actually calm him down a lot. He felt a lot of getting in control of his inner life, channeling his inner life, writing about the problems of the day. Later on, as he started to mix it up with Benzedrine and coffee and nicotine, and whiskey, when he was mixing all those up, when he, later on in the journal, you can see that he does get a little combustible about it. I mean, mixed with all those other things, it was a problem. So he was always trying to figure out how much can you use? When is the right way to use it? How do you do it with a lot of black coffee? How do you do it with cigarettes, whiskey, and so forth? Sleep, sex, how are all those things interacting? That was really one of the main thrusts of the journal. Wouldn't you say so, Sue?
I would say the same thing, yes. And I also think that marijuana opened up a whole world to him. He talks about it in the journal, about how he goes into the caverns of his mind, that he touches insanity, that he comes out of it, but that he has to do it. He's scared, but he has to do it because it's a journey that is very important to him. And at the same time, he was writing to his friend Bob Linder, and he would write the entries into the journal and send them to Bob, and then Bob would comment on them. But I think that Norman wanted Bob to be his psychoanalyst, and Bob, of course, said no because they were very good friends. And as time wore on, something started happening to Norman with the with all the combustible elements that he was taking into his body that Mike mentioned, and he started to get distrustful, and even I would even say a little bit paranoid. And he started thinking that maybe Bob didn't approve of him, which was true. He didn't approve of all that marijuana, and that maybe he wasn't really his friend. So as Norman says in one interview, I think it was an interview with you, Mike, he said, those who love marijuana were my friends, and those who didn't were against me. So there was a fallout with Bob Linder for a while, and then they became friends again. They made up and became friends again until Bob died very young at the age of, I think, 41. And
41,
Norman at that time. Yeah, 41. And Norman was at that time 34 or 35, so he was very young. But I agree with Mike. Yeah, in the beginning it was very good for him, and then later on it turned out to be something that I would say even frightened him.
Well, a listener asked about Norman's risk taking, and he took it to a new level personally, but yet he got 84 years. He lived a full life. And he battled, as you know, Michael and Susan, he battled great odds at the end and stayed alive longer than probably most people would have, because he was a fighter to the very end. But when I picture him writing, I picture him boxing. He was an aggressive guy, and he wrote aggressively. And I would imagine somebody like that probably needed something to soothe his senses every now and then.
But, yeah. You know, I would think that... he wasn't always an aggressive guy. He was he had this nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn persona that he really did not like at all. And one of the things that marijuana and coffee and bourbon and scotch did for him, and cigarettes, was to make him a rebel. And I think that was the main thing that happened in those 3 months that he was writing the journal, and that he was smoking marijuana heavily, is that he tapped into himself, into the rebel side of him, and he became a rebel after that.
Michael?
Yeah. Let me add to that what Susan says. Remember, right after this, Mailer was the co-founder of the Village Voice. This happened almost immediately after. He invested in the Village Voice almost immediately after he stopped the journal and published and finished The Deer Park, which finally got accepted. And then after that, he started working on advertisements for myself. So those are the books where Norman Mailer became Norman Mailer, the Village Voice columns, and then they're, of course, repeated in advertisements for myself, where he is no longer the detached artist. He's going to open himself up to everything and tell all. And he does an awful lot of that. So it was really the marijuana experience in Lipton's was a tipping point into a new kind of Norman Mailer. He wasn't going to be the observer anymore, watching things. He was going to be the participant. He was going to be an actor on the stage of the American scene. And that's, of course, when it happened. That's when he developed his style in advertisements for myself. But without Lipton's, it wouldn't have happened.
Now, a listener asked, was Norman high when he was on the Dick Cavett show in that memorable showdown with Gore Vidal? Michael, he probably was drinking. I don't know if he was
drinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had a couple of drinks ahead of time. I know. Yeah. When he was on the Cavett show, and he head bumped Gore Vidal in the green room. And that's why, if you watch the show carefully, you'll see that Gore keeps rubbing his forehead because he had a headache. Norman had a hard head.
Susan, was he ever aggressive with you?
Verbally, he could be aggressive. Yes, he wanted to take us to. He wanted us to be very good debaters. He wanted us to be very smart, and so he was always putting us against the wall, discussing different issues with us that many times we didn't understand. You know, when I was 12 or 13 or 15, there were a lot of things I didn't understand, but that he wanted me to understand. So I would say he could be aggressive verbally. Or pushy, maybe, might be the word. He wanted to push me and all my siblings to certain levels that, you know, to higher levels. But he was never aggressive physically, ever.
The book is Lipton's A Marijuana Journal, and two people who are keeping the flame alive of one of the great writers and great characters of his time or any time, Norman Mailer. J. Michael Lennon and Susan Mailer. I mentioned the Mailer Conference that's been going on for many years, and I've never attended. I endeavor to go this year. I hear it's in St. Petersburg. Tell me more.
Yes, it's going to be in St. Petersburg. I don't know the exact date. It's in the end of November. But you can go to the Norman Mailer Society website online. It has all the details. And it's going to be in a hotel down in the water, down there. And there's a lot of folks in Florida who are members of the Mailer Society. That's where the Norman Mailer Review is published, at University of South Florida in Tampa. And so we're going to have a good group coming from there. And we will be, Susan and I will be on some kind of a panel there talking about Lipton's. Well, it'll be the really time. people will see the book, the people in the society, a lot of them won't have seen it until then.
Was there ever a concern, Susan, that he would harm himself?
I don't believe so. No, I never had that feeling, ever.
But he was...
I think he harmed himself by drinking as much as he did, by fighting as much as he did, and by punishing his body the way he did many, many times, I mean, throughout his whole life. But I did never have the feeling that he would harm himself, like suicide or anything like that. No, never.
Well, thank you for sharing the story of a man whose legacy is immense. And I think long after all of us are gone, people will still be reading the words of Norman Mailer, one of the great American writers. Susan Mailer, his daughter, oldest child, and Michael Lennon, his dear friend and biographer and archivist. And the book, again, is Lipton's A Marijuana Journal. We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Susan. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Back in just a few with more. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and Fred Columbus Dent III is in the house, and he is an underwriter for WRKF, and we're pleased with that, but we're pleased to have him in studio. And before we talk with Fred, do want to note that Richard Zuschlag, the founder and owner of Acadian Ambulance, has died at 76, cancer. And I saw him a few months ago at the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame, of which he is a member. And I told him that it would be hard-pressed for anybody to be after him because his name starts with Z-U. And then I realized I went to school with a guy named Zelensky who was Z-Y, but I don't think he's going to be in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame.
He's around here.
Yeah, but anyway, we'll miss Richard Zuschlag, who was on this show. Fine man, great contributor to Louisiana. And also Danny Plaisance, the owner of Cottonwood Books, has died. And he was another guest of renown. And a few years ago, he met one Tom Hanks, who came in the store and bought It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium and wanted to meet John Ed Bradley. And he did. And Tom and John Ed are now big buddies. Started with a meeting with Danny Plaisance, who for many years operated his bookstore next to Panetta's on Perkins Road. And unfortunately, it closed when he retired. But we'll always remember Cottonwood and Danny. And what a gracious fellow he was. And this all comes on the heels of last Friday's death of Smiley Gray Anders Jr. So we lost some fine people in Louisiana over the last few days. And Fred Dent is in the house, and it's been a topsy-turvy year for the market. Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is the one that most people follow, but there's the NASDAQ, there's the Standard & Poor's. What do you generally follow, or is it a combination, Fred?
We look at everything. The Dow. It's interesting you mentioned the Dow and the S&P 500. The Dow was up about 2.5% this year. Remember, that's the 30, primarily, at least in the old days, industrial stocks, 2.5%. The S&P 500, which has a very tech-heavy focus, is up 11% year-to-date, primarily led by those Magnificent Seven stocks with those big names that we all know, like Amazon and NVIDIA, the chip maker, et cetera. So I follow both. We look at everything. We look at the yield on the 10-year Treasury to tell us where the general interest rate level is, oil prices, gold. Even Bitcoin's interesting to follow these days. It's at $70,000 per coin.
Well, I hear a lot of supporters, and we won't harp on this, but of President Biden talking about the market being at an all-time high. Well, as we noted, it should always be at an all-time high. If it's $1 more than it was when Donald Trump left, it's at an all-time high. But the truth is, neither Trump nor Biden has kept pace with Obama or Clinton. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in their 8 years in office tripled. Under Trump, it went from 20 to 31,000, and under Biden, it's gone from 31 to, where is it right now, as we speak, 38,628. So there's not a whole lot to choose from. Actually, Trump has a little better record when it comes to the Dow, but people, I don't know if they respond to this, but both are making the claim that they did a better job with the economy. How much is the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the other stock indicators, how much is that is reflective of the economy, or does the market move by itself?
Well, we don't use the word stock market. We talk about ownership of superior businesses. And right now, Americans are the wealthiest they've ever been. There is $13,000 in liquid assets and money market CDs and checking accounts, record levels of home equity available if they want to draw upon that, record levels of the stock market. Things are looking really good. So what could go wrong? Well, a lot of stuff. And I think this election outcome, as our friend Jim Carville or James Carville said, it's the economy, stupid. People will vote for their pocketbooks. And as we go closer and closer to November, we'll see how the economy unfolds. Already today, we got some economic indicators that show that payroll growth is slowing a little bit. The Bank of Canada earlier today dropped their benchmark interest rate by a quarter of a point. So far in the U.S., we're not cutting interest rates, but if the economy continues to slow, then that's in our future.
877-217-5757 is your number, and Fred Dent is in the house, financial analyst now since October 19th, 1987, coming up on 37 years. His first day on the job was Black Monday. That was a bad day for the market.
22%, 23% down.
But on the whole, the market did well under Reagan. Didn't do as well under Reagan as it did under Bush or Obama, but it did well. The national debt, some listener, this is Hal in Monroe, says, well, it's now $34,796,000,000,000. That's a huge number, and it's going up. It's going up, up, up. There will always be a debt going up unless we get no deficit at all. And right now, it's just rising like crazy. But when I look at these market capital numbers, Microsoft and Apple by themselves are over $3 trillion. Two companies. To United States companies. So should we be as alarmed as that $34 trillion figure might make us if we didn't know, put it in perspective with other numbers?
Well, alarm is never a word that we should only use like once in our lifetime when it comes to investing. There are concerns that crop up from time to time. I go back to 1971. There was a massive concern that we were leaving the gold standard. I don't know if you remember that or not. I was a young lad. And indeed, in August, Nixon closed the gold window, and we went off of the gold standard. The S&P 500 was at 100 then. Today, it's, 5,200? Yes, 5,200. It's risen by 10% per year, and $100 invested in the S&P 500 then is now worth $23,000 today. So look at the global financial crisis of 2008, or even COVID. We have these pullbacks, but the market marches on.
877-217-5757 for Fred Dent, Patrick, and Innisfil Estates. Patrick, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Fred. So I got a question about Bitcoin. To me, it seems like a Ponzi scheme. I guess the original idea of Bitcoin was supposed to kind of mimic the dollar. People would use it as like a money, but it seems like people just buy it and hold on to it to sell it to someone else for a higher price. And it has all the signs of a Ponzi scheme. Am I wrong? I guess I'd like to hear your opinion on it.
Well, I'll tell you about what I think about Bitcoin. I wouldn't call it a Ponzi scheme in the sense that you have a primary actor who's out there with a scheme defrauding investors. However, it is an asset, and it is a curious asset. What I think a lot of people confuse are confused about Bitcoin is they think it's some kind of investment. And it's really just a medium of exchange, like the U.S. dollar. I can exchange a dollar for a Bitcoin, for a euro, for a Japanese yen. It is simply a medium of exchange that happens to be rising against the U.S. dollar. Now, where it goes from here, who knows? But it does seem if you're putting money into Bitcoin exclusively, you are speculating. You are speculating, not investing.
Thank you, Patrick. 877-217-5757 is your number. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. Good morning, sir. Good
morning.
All right. Do we have Phil? I think we lost him.
We've lost.
Renee?
Hello. I'm sorry. I hung up when I was trying to pick up. Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air, Phil.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have a question. Being encouraged to use cash as a reason that helps our economy because we it holds on to its value. Like when you spend $50, it goes into the economy and it's still worth $50 or can be broken down. Anyway, is that good advice? Thanks.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you?
I don't know. Obviously, when when you use a credit card, there's some charges involved in that transaction. In cash, there isn't. So I guess if you look at it that way, when you're operating with cash, you're not getting all the excess charges that might be involved in doing it another way.
This brings up, separate to that question, this reminds me of something that happened the other day. I had somebody call me and they said, Fred, we're worried about the U.S. dollar or the U.S. government issuing digital currency, because that means they're going to be able to control our money, track every transaction, et cetera, et cetera. And usually when I hear that, I know that they're focused on particular news sources that seem to amplify this. And I just asked that particular person, I said, well, how much money do you actually have in cash? He said, a couple hundred dollars in my wallet. I said, that's right. Everything else that you have is already digital currency. Your bank deposits, your credit card charges, everything is electronic. You don't take physical possession of cash anymore. We have a de facto digital currency for which the government can track us already. So we're already, and we have been for many years, into that digital society.
James in Metairie. Good morning, James. You're on with Fred.
Hi, Jim. Good morning. Hello to your guests. You know, yesterday, little Mikey MAGA Johnson, a pathetic, pitiful...
All right, well, let's suspend with that, okay, James. Okay. What's your question?
Claim again that the greatest economy in the history of the world was under Donald Trump. PolitiFact says no. Yes, unemployment was low under Donald Trump. However, GDP was well below average, and other metrics such as wages and business investment range from decent to mediocre. Thanks, Jim.
All right, well, thank you, James, but... The economy, as James Carville said, it's the economy, stupid, often determines who wins or loses a presidential election. And the economy was mixed under Trump. It's mixed under Biden. But both are making cases that they're better than the other. Fred, do you think people pay attention to this? Or do they look at their 401k and they say I'm doing pretty well and I commend the president? Or if they're not doing well, saying I blame the president.
H.L. Mencken, who wrote for the Baltimore Sun, I believe, the old curmudgeon himself, once said, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamoring to be led to safety by an endless series of hobgoblins, most of them imaginary. And politicians are trying to deflect everywhere, left and right, and try to make their case. It has very little to do with how wealthy we are, how much money we have in the bank, etc.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Fred Dent, financial analyst, and we're back after this brief timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana. Pleased you're with us, and if you'd like to get in under the wire with Fred Dent, 877-217-5757. James in Longview, good to hear from you, James. Good morning to you, sir.
Well, good morning, sir. Anyhow, you've been discussing the stock markets going up, up, up so much in the last few years. I just want to ask, is the law of probabilities kind of showing that there's kind of apt to be a correction one of these days and probably before the election? And that might cause some real hobgoblins. What are your thoughts?
Well, I want to comment on that a bit because I mentioned the stock market tripled under Obama, and he left it, and it was 20,000. So if the market had kept pace with what he did, Biden and Trump would have it at 60,000 right now. 60,000, and it's at 38,000. So they have underperformed. And I would say the market probably is one who invests in the market, but I don't put everything I got in it. But I would say it's probably due for an uptick rather than a downtick.
Who knows? But on average, every year since 1920-something, the market has a correction of about 10% per year. Every several years, say 3 to 4 years, we have a 20% pullback. And then once every 5 to 10 to beyond years, we have 30 to 40% pullbacks. It's one, two, three, four steps forward, one step back, two, three, four steps forward, two steps back. It is a progression based on the earnings of these superior businesses who are solving human needs, wants, and desires all around the world.
Well, the stock that has the greatest market capital right now is not Amazon, it's not Apple, it's still Microsoft at $3.11 trillion. But even the great Microsoft, as I look right now, it's at $4.19. The 52-week high is $4.34. So there are ups and downs even when you have the best of stocks, right?
Indeed. I mean, as Morgan Housel said, that every investment price, every market valuation is just a number multiplied by a story about tomorrow.
David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Dent. Paul Krugman has written that the Trump's trade tariffs would cost the economy
$700,000. By the way, it's the
jobs.
Trump-Biden trade tariffs.
Yeah, they both seem to like tariffs. Well,
they love tariffs a lot, and Biden loves them even more than Trump.
Well, I'm talking about the newly additional proposed tax trade tariffs proposed by Donald Trump. I don't think Biden is proposing as anywhere near as many. But anyway, Paul Krugman wrote it would cost 700,000 jobs, and it would cost the economy trillions of dollars. And it would also exacerbate inflation.
All right. Well, what about the – obviously, they believe it would benefit the American working people.
It benefits special industries. It is a tax on the American consumer, ultimately.
Right. And that's what David was getting at. Yeah. It's that something Trump is dead wrong about. He's saying China will pay for the tariffs. No, they won't. No. We will pay for the tariffs.
Indeed.
We will pay for the tariffs.
Attention, Walmart shoppers. Your prices have risen.
But Biden said he was going to reverse that, and he didn't do it.
No.
So that's politics. And Fred tries to stay out of politics, but it's a political world. This is a political year. And ultimately, I remember Eric Severide saying that when George Bush was running against Michael Dukakis, and it looked like Bush had it in the bag, and he did, he said that if something like October 19th of 87 happened in 88, then
all bets are off.
All bets are off. So there is a component involving politics and what happens on Wall Street. And Fred Dent is a man with his finger on the pulse, and we look forward to your visit again next month, if you'll come back. I hope you will.
I will.
Thank you, sir. And we're joined in short order by some people involving a major event involving BRAC and Pride series at the Independence Theater. But I do want to note that the library is also involved. Queer History Film Series, an exploration into LGBTQ history, influence, politics, and gaiety through the ages in partnership with Baton Rouge Pride. This series will feature a different film on the last Sunday of each month, continuing with Coming Out, a 50-year history that will be seen at the main library at Goodwood Sunday, June 30th. So we're a little ways away from that, as today is June the 5th. By the way, tomorrow is D-Day, and one of our guests appropriately will be Russell Honoré, who was not alive in 1944, but he knows a lot about what happened on the beaches at Normandy. And in studio are a couple of people involved with the event this weekend. It's Saturday at the Independence Park Theater, and this is a case in which I'm just meeting these people who have been nice enough to come to the studio, and if you can, could you identify yourselves, please?
Yes. Hi, I'm Heather Prudham. I manage Queens of Louisiana. It's a local drag art group corporation, nonprofit.
And my name is John Lyons. I am the director of Queens of Louisiana under Heather. And in drag, I go by Miss Tara Hole Royale.
Well, this sounds like an interesting event Saturday.
Yes. Yes, sir. Very much. We've made sure to include the entire community, from children to all ages.
Well, what will happen? It's an all-day affair, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, sir. It will kick off around 12:30 with a Pride March. It will go on throughout the day until around 6 or 7 p.m.
So it starts at 12:30 until 7 at the Independence Park Theater. To purchase tickets, you can go to the BRAC Independence Park Theater website or...
And now that is just for the inside events. We did make sure to offer an entire outside world that is free to the public, and it's all ages friendly. There will be bouncy houses, glitter parties, hand fan painting contest, popcorn, balloon selfie walls, and all that is free to the public.
All right. And I note that there will be a Pride in the Park event from 12:30 to 4, correct?
Yes.
That one's free, correct?
Yes, yes.
And a listener asked about the Queen's Court.
Yes, that is the ticketed part that goes on inside. That is $25 a ticket, and that will give you all of the awesome little events we have going on, such as drag bingo, drag 101 class, lip sync battle, and other fun items.
Well, these kinds of events probably 20 years ago would not be held, or if they would, they wouldn't be publicized. We're in a different world, and I think that's a good thing. But are there some misconceptions? This is not a crazy event. You're obviously a group that warrants respect, and you're what exactly will happen as far as showcasing what you believe is right in our world?
When it comes to example like the outside events, we have teamed up with a bunch of local resource vendors who will be providing just tons of different little resources to the community. And it gives you an opportunity to meet those people that maybe you don't know how to reach out to them.
And it's a lot of things like Mapping Trans Joy. That is one of our big sponsors that we have out there, our local resource vendors. We're also bringing in Rainbow Connection, Planned Parenthood, and another one, Small Talk Counseling and Consulting. Things that you might not think about while you're out at an event having a good time, but you are amongst friends, and a lot of these resource vendors are here as friends as well to help people.
How did you get involved, Heather?
This Queens of Louisiana started out as a basic fan club 3 years ago, and then we've turned it into an event company where we team up with local businesses here who want to have different types of drag art introduction events to the community. And we started doing a couple things with Breck, the Art Independence Theater, Zenobi Indigo, shout out to him. He is the best director of the art theater. His dream also was always to have a little Pride in the Park celebration, and he reached out to us.
And as far as the people involved, you literally have people in the hundreds who are working hand in glove with you, don't you?
Yes, yes. It's a beautiful thing.
It's going to be a big production, too. We got people blowing up balloons. That part takes so much longer than you'd think. I have so much more respect for the balloon arch decorators after we did it last year, because it is... It is all hands on deck, though. We have lots of people coming out.
I see you've got a bunch of local art vendors who are participating. And any of those that stand out above perhaps others that are, they got so many of them, I can't name them all.
No.
But anyone in particular that you'd like to?
No, we love them all equally. Everybody and everyone is treated equal to us. And I did want to add, it is not too late for any food, resource, or art vendors to sign up and be a part.
All right. I'm looking at the court events. There's something called a match game show. What happens with match game show?
So the match game is kind of like a take on the show Drag Race. They have a classic challenge called the snatch game, and it is like a celebrity impression where you try to look and sound like the person that you're trying to emulate.
Okay.
And it's almost like a game show, but...
All right.
You could end up having people like Cher, Barbara Streisand, and Meryl Streep, you know, sitting on the board.
Okay, and at 2:30, there's drag bingo. What happens with drag bingo?
It's just a traditional bingo, but it's hosted by the drag queen, so the jokes are way funnier.
And drag 101?
That's going to be a little light introduction to drag 101, like how to install wigs, maybe a little sachet.
How much your back hurts after a performance.
All right. And a listener asked a good question. This do they want their name mentioned? No. what about straight people? Are they welcome? Can they come?
Everyone. We literally have something for everyone. Even if you're just into variety, talents, and poetry, we have a section for you.
Well, hats off to Breck and Collis Temple, longtime board member.
Yes.
Who made this happen. So at the Independence Park Theater, 12:30 to 7 this Saturday, and you can go through the Breck Independence Theater website. Thank you so much. Appreciate you, Heather. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. And back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.